Welcome to the Fourth Watch Podcast, a curated conversation with some of the most interesting voices in the media. I'm Steve Krakauer. Today, we're talking to my former boss, the founder of Mediaite, and the host of the new show, Dan Abrams Live on News Nation. Yes, Dan Abrams. This is episode 25. On hosting a show on MSNBC and as an executive running it, on the state of cable news overall, on the Aussie drama and the cancellation of Live PD, we start with a recent push by the broader media to demonize and scapegoat Facebook. I want to start with a thing that I've been thinking a lot about this week. There was the Facebook whistleblower on 60 Minutes, and then she was talking in front of Congress, and I've been writing about this in Fourth Watch also, and I'm curious your take on it. So I'm trying to figure out why Facebook has become sort of the boogeyman here, why there's this, what feels like a moral panic happening right now. It reminds me of like the video game craze, like in when there were some school shootings. Are violent video games leading to this? What is it about not just politicians, but the media that are making Facebook into the bad guy here? And I've tried to identify it. Maybe there's two things. Maybe it's something that, you know, Facebook had such a huge impact on people's businesses in the media business. You know, they said, oh, you know, do this kind of content and we'll fix it. You know, we'll put it in the algorithm and it'll do really well. New video and now, okay, that'll do really well. And then they change it again, really messes with their business model. Or maybe it's a Trump, you know, holdover. You know, they're still trying to figure out how they can find some reason to explain the shock of Trump winning. And oh, it must just be that people are getting radicalized on this place called Facebook. What do you think of it? And what do you think of the media coverage of places like Facebook now and all of social media as this really negative thing?
Well, look, I think that it's a very unifying theme between the left and the right for different reasons, to hate social media, right? I mean, it's like hating the media in general. Everyone loves to hate the media. You love to hate Congress. It's easy to hate a giant that is so powerful and can be so influential. But I think that, you know, with Facebook, I think it has come down to different reasons for different people disliking Facebook. And is there not enough regulation? Is it too powerful? But I'm not remotely surprised that it has become sort of, you know, the thing to do, which is to hate Facebook, except that, you know, tons of people still use it and really like using it. So it becomes almost like a slogan, like I hate Congress, I hate the media, I hate Facebook, I hate the weatherman. It becomes one of those things that people just say. And I guess, you know, it's not really fair to weather people because these days they really tend to be much more accurate than when I was younger and everyone would claim that they never got it right. So that's my thinking on why it's become the boogeyman.
Yeah, I mean, it is right. I mean, Facebook is this thing that can't be controlled by, and it's really, I would say, it almost in competition with places like a CNN or you know, certainly places like a BuzzFeed, where all of a sudden, you know, that it has wields this real power. And maybe it starts to have this sort of competing interests, and all of a sudden now we've got to, you know, crack down on them.
But it's not a competing interest. It's that they can impact their business so much, right? Yeah. I mean, you know, if Facebook turns off the spigot, you know, that impacts significantly their businesses. I don't think it's that they're competing, I guess, with them a bit for ad dollars, right? I mean, there's so many ad dollars going to Facebook. And those are ad dollars that I'm sure CNN and BuzzFeed and others like would love to have. So in that sense, there probably is a bit of competitive spirit behind it. But I think that, you know, I think it's frustrating to these giants to have some bigger giant who can literally, you know, can have a major impact on your business.
MSNBC and CNN, then and now. What has changed in the world of cable news over the past 20 years? let's look back at where the media has gone over the last, let's say, 20 years, because 20 years ago, you were hosting a show on MSNBC called The Abrams Report. And then shortly after that, a few years later, became the GM of MSNBC. I try to do as much research as I can. And I found this incredible headline in the New York Times about your appointment as GM of MSNBC by Bill Carter. This was in 2006, the 40-year-old virgin executive. It's pretty smart.
It was good.
You know, even then you were talking about that, you know, there needed to be less newscasty as you described it, which I have to say kind of really foretold where cable news, particularly MSNBC, went in the intervening years. What do you remember of that time in cable news when you had a show 20 years ago, when you became GM 15 years ago, and how does that kind of change, or how does that look compared to where things are now?
Well, I can describe it to you by naming names, which will shock people, of people who used to be hosts at MSNBC. Laura Ingraham, Tucker Carlson, Pat Buchanan, Alan Keyes.
Yeah, I had a trivia question that was going to come, which was who replaced you when you became GM, and it was Tucker Carlson.
When I became GM, I guess Tucker took over the 6 o'clock
slot.
And look, yeah. I was a big advocate of Tucker's, and Tucker, you know, he knows that I was very much behind supporting Tucker's show. But you know, the days of having balance are over. And I'll say that you know, it didn't quite work in the sense that when you fill up the stadium with Laura Ingraham fans or Tucker Carlson fans, et cetera, you simply can't have either a straight newscast or particularly a liberal opinion person coming right after. It just doesn't work. So, you know, we are in a fundamentally different place. And I will say one of the things that I pushed for when I was running MSNBC was we got to pick a lane.
Yeah.
And you know, look, even though that lane didn't always match with my personal politics, we had to pick it, and we did, and we went hard. We went hard left, and it worked, because that's what people seem to want, was a place where they can go to have their views reinforced, and suddenly the numbers started shooting up.
Right.
As we stopped trying to have a diversity of views and to focus more on the greatest part of the end of that story is that, so I finished becoming, I'm finished as GM, and I hate it by the end. I'm begging Jeff Zucker to get out of it, because I had no autonomy. They, you know, it's a little exaggeration, but I didn't have enough autonomy.
There were a lot of executives there.
There were a lot of executives, a lot of people, everything I had to go through and this and this and that. And so I begged to get out of the job, and I begged to have my show back. And the hour that happened to be available at that time was the 9 p.m. hour, because Joe Scarborough was going to the morning to do Morning Joe, and his show at 9 o'clock had not worked. And so I started doing the show that was kind of balanced. That right. was, you know, 2008, it was McCain versus Hillary. Who won today? You know, who told the truth today? Who this? And it just wasn't nearly as popular as the more straight left-leaning shows. And that's why, you know, when they announced, when they told me that they were going to put Rachel Maddow in, I said, that makes a ton of sense. I don't know how else to say it. I mean, I don't want to lose the show, but I also can't possibly defend you keeping me there based on where the audience is.
Well, your lead in to the 9 p.m. show was Keith Olbermann,
who, right,
you
exactly.
know, really, I think was emblematic of where MSNBC went and has continued to go. Although I have to say, I think that MSNBC has gotten a lot smarter than kind of the show that Keith did back then with Rachel and with some of the other choices they've made. I think that there's a different emphasis. Obviously, it's very left-leaning, but there's a shift in some way from trying to emulate the Fox model in some capacity to trying to be like, I don't know how to describe it, the New York Times op-ed page on TV or something. I don't know. But
well, and one of the things I think that they did that was smart was that they built the primetime around Rachel Maddow, right? I mean, you know, Chris Hayes is so similar in so many ways to Rachel Maddow, just in his delivery, in his take on stories, et cetera, that, you know, that made a lot of sense. And, you know, I think that Hayes and Maddow in particular are very complementary with one another. Lawrence O'Donnell is a bit more of the old school, you know, kind of bombast host.
Yeah, and, I mean, you got a West Wing writer at 10 p.m. So, you know.
Yeah. No, look, but I think that they all, I didn't mean that. I don't mean that as an insult.
No,
I mean it because, look, I'm more bombastic than are either Rachel Maddow or Chris Hayes in my delivery. So I say that as a, you know, a bit of a fellow bombaster. I think that what they're doing is working, and there's a reason that they're beating CNN.
Right.
That's because they're not doing opinion that is particularly dissimilar from what CNN is doing in the evenings.
Well, that's a key thing, because I want to ask you about that. You mentioned Jeff Zucker, who was, I guess, at the time, sort of your boss when he was running NBC. Yep. At the time. Now he's running CNN. And I do, I agree with you. I look at it and I say, MSNBC, there's an honesty to where they're coming from, that as much as I loved working for CNN, I went to CNN after working for you at Mediaite. I enjoyed my time there and I enjoyed working with Jeff. But they've gone into this weird place where they are something that they are pretending they are not. And it's hard to square that. And I feel like I don't understand why they're doing that. But I wonder, as a person who's been in the media world for a long time and who also watched it as someone who started Mediaite, what do you think of where they are now and kind of the choice that they've made to try to thread this needle?
I think the problem that a lot of these opinion hosts have is that they call themselves journalists. I've said about my new News Nation show, right? I've said, I'm not going to tell you that I'm unbiased. I'm not going to pretend that I'm just playing it straight.
Yeah.
And the problem is that's what you see on CNN is everyone. And by the way, some of the people on MSNBC will tell you the same thing, that, you know, that they're, I'm just laying it out. Hey, I'm not an opinion guy. I'm just giving you the facts. I'm just telling you, I'm just doing analysis. It's like, no, stop. Stop. No one believes you. And just own it. Own it. And I think you're right that Fox in primetime owns it. MSNBC largely owns it. And I think that the problem for CNN is, rather than owning that CNN in primetime is now opinion and in the morning, instead they just want to claim that they're just journalists giving you the facts. And, you know, I think that the journalists, in my view, and look, I used to be a journalist. I'm not a journalist anymore.
Me too.
I used to go out and cover stories, break news, gather information and report it back.
Yeah.
That's what a journalist does. When you get to sit in a studio and offer your opinion on a variety of topics, just call yourself an opinion host. Call yourself a host. But don't call yourself, don't lump yourself in with the people who are out there doing the hard work every day as journalists. And that's why, you know, one of the promos that we've been doing for my new show has been around, I'm not going to pretend. So we'll see.
I don't get it. I mean, and I don't want to go too into, you know, naming names, but, you know, Chris Cuomo, I know you and I know, I think you know him better than I do. But I worked with him. I enjoyed working with him. Don Lemon. I would say to them, you know, I feel like your show would be more successful if you would just be honest about it. Like I mean, maybe it's like this idea of you get into that building and you've got the ghost of Ted Turner and this idea that you might be able to, you know, say, okay, we're not doing hard news, where I'm not a news program, is somehow like sacrilege. But wouldn't it be more successful if they just said that, like you're saying?
I do think that there is a larger issue at CNN, which is that, you know, if you were to say what I just said, right, which is, I'm not a journalist anymore. I am a host of a show, an opinion host. I'm a business person. et cetera, that you would be ostracized internally. And there would the people would be saying, well, you know, I didn't come here to work on a, you know, a quasi news show. And it's funny because when I interviewed people for my show, I said to them, because, you know, a lot of them were people who had news backgrounds, right? Yeah. And I said to them, I want to be really clear about what I'm doing here. Okay. This is not going to be a straight news show. We're going to do almost no news reports. We're going to be doing analysis. We're going to be breaking down what is happening. I'm going to be having a take on things. I'm going to have guests who either disagree with me or who are going to add additional information. And it helped me weed out a couple of people, particularly for high-level jobs, who wanted to do a newscast. And that's, I respect that. I'm not mocking it in any way. But the bottom line is there's a reason that, you know, Shepard Smith does a really good newscast every day, that even though it's on a major network like CNBC, is watched by so few people. It's not Shepard's fault.
Yeah.
But it's just because that's what they insist on doing.
Is it good? I've never actually seen it.
It is good. It is good. You know what? It's well produced. It's fast paced. I mean, again, 15 years ago, that would be like, you know, it was sort of like, remember, this is really digging into the archives. Do you remember the show, The News with Brian Williams, that used to air on MSNBC?
Yes, I think so.
It was pre Brian getting the NBC Nightly News.
Yeah, it broke all.
And obviously pre controversy, et cetera. Right. And it was like a really kind of fast paced news program. They had reports, right? The NBC News reporters would file packages for the show. They do live shots, et cetera. You know, it was a really informative show. The world is a different place now with the internet. We don't need, you know, straight news. I mean, look, I actually find the network newscast to be kind of refreshing in many ways. But beyond that, newscasts simply will not work on cable, period.
Right.
And everyone knows that. It's just a question of who's going to admit it or not.
And who's going to be honest about it, right? Right. I want to ask you about your news show as well, but I want to go back to one thing you mentioned, Tucker Carlson. You said you were his boss at one point. What did you see in him then? And what do you think of his real cable news dominance now? I know obviously he is the highest rated or the second highest rated, but in terms of the cultural conversation that is around cable news, he seems to dominate in ways that I don't know if we've seen potentially ever.
Well, because he's saying things that other people aren't saying. I mean, you know, he goes much further than Sean Hannity would ever go in terms of, you know, his various theories, you know, replacement theory, whatever the controversy du jour is. Tucker, I think more than anything, loves getting a rise out of the liberal media. And I think to some degree, he's so addicted to that, that he'll almost say anything when he can envision the next day heads exploding at more mainstream news organizations. He's always sort of enjoyed that. I think he's taking it to an extreme these days, but I think that's what drives him. I think as a result, that's what drives the conversation around him. And look, he's a different, you know, he's a different host than he was back then, just in terms of the positions that he takes. He used to, in my view, be a sort of straight conservative. And, you know, now I think he's gotten a lot wackier. But boy, is his show working.
Yeah. I mean, he definitely has a certain kind of uniqueness to him. He's not going to toe the party line, which I think, you know, love him or hate him is something different. So that is, as you mentioned, working. Okay. Dan Abrams Live on News Nation, 8 p.m. Eastern. So you're thrust into the cable news primetime landscape. And you talked about when the show launched last month about trying to get viewers who are not stuck in their echo chambers. And I'm curious, as now you're a few weeks in, when you look at kind of what does success look like? Are you looking at ratings? Are you looking at kind of digital reach and conversation? How do you gauge if you're reaching the right people? Because it is, as you mentioned, it is a very different landscape now in 2021.
Right. So initially, I'm not going to be looking at ratings because it would be too depressing. So, you know, that's not good because, you know, people don't even know about News Nation yet.
Yeah.
It's about the first step is getting people to realize that they actually have it. If you have cable, you have News Nation. If you have an OTT stream, one of the major OTT streamers, you have News Nation. People don't realize the first question I get is, how do I watch it? And my point is, go to your guide and find it. And the reason is because it's a new network that, you know, they acquired WGN America, the old cable channel, and have now taken all that distribution and created it into News Nation. And, you know, I hadn't been looking for a gig on cable. I have not had a single conversation with, you know, anyone at MSNBC or CNN or Fox or, you know, or any of them about hosting a cable news show in years. And the reason for that is because I just didn't think that what I do, knowing it's opinion that works, that my kind of opinion has a home right now. And so I didn't even bother. And so when I went to talk to the News Nation folks about something else, it was a business partnership that I was talking to them about.
Oh, interesting.
We started talking about what they ought to be doing. And, you know, they had initially been branding themselves and spent a lot of time and effort at really trying to be unbiased, meaning in their newscasts, taking literally people marking up scripts to try to take any sort of judgment bias, et cetera, out of the scripts. And my position was, you know, that's a great, noble goal, but it's never going to get viewers. And they knew that. It's not like I came in with like a, you know, like I was the great sage and they were like, oh, thank goodness Dan Abrams taught us the way. And it's not what happened. But they were very, you know, we were very sort of on the same page about what kinds of shows would work. And so the conversation shifted where they weren't particularly interested in my business proposition, but they were interested in me hosting a show. And, you know, I laid out for them as we talked more what, in my view, this show would look like, which is you're not going to know how I'm going to come down on a variety of issues.
Right.
I'm going to, you know, the right is going to call me liberal and the left, you know, it's funny because, you know, I've used this example that, you know, people on the right, including people you know well, have referred to me as center left. And people like, you know, Don Lemon has called me center right. And I take that as a compliment. That doesn't mean I'm doing everything right, by the way. People always say, well, it means you're doing everything right. No, it doesn't. It could mean I'm an idiot who takes, you know, dumb positions that are, you know, sort of center-ish. But, you know, the reason I'm doing this is because I know that the vast majority of Americans view themselves as right or left of center. The question just becomes, will they come watch a cable news show that they don't necessarily agree with all the time, right? They'll say, yeah, generally I agree with him. Oh, but yeah, he did the segment that really pissed me off. You don't get that on Fox or MSNBC or CNN. It's feel good, right? And so the question is, are people going to come to be challenged to find me engaging, but also to say I may disagree with him in certain cases? And that's, we'll have to see. But big picture answer to your question is, long-term, it's going to be ratings, it's going to be digital engagement, it's going to be all of it.
I think that the majority of the country is not hard-lined one direction or the other.
Not,
I mean, I think most people are messy, you know, and I think that, and if they're not, they have a much greater appetite to consume things that they're not just like only being told what they you know already believe in, then because they're everyday life, their family, their friends are not people that they don't only surround themselves with one group of people. Coming up, Dan Abrams started Mediaite 8 years ago. I was the founding TV editor there at the time. How has that site evolved? And where does it sit now in the entire media marketplace? That's next. But first, let's talk about Gawker, new Gawker. Because the original Gawker had some great periods and some less successful periods, but it always felt essential. If you were at all interested in the world of media, you had to check it out multiple times a week just to see what was brewing from that Soho office. It has now been more than 2 months since the relaunched Gawker returned, and I think we've seen enough to assess its place in the media landscape. And so far, the results are extremely underwhelming. There are the stories which appear to be an attempt at obscure humor, but are just odd. There's a story called Pass the Pepper, which is about how pepper is good. Pepper is a true star, not just an accomplice or distraction, and there's more to heavy peppering than the finishing touch, reads the short blog post. Or here's something that, again, I think is meant to be funny. Do you wish you had a tail, is the headline, and it's sort of what you'd expect. Do you wish you had a tail? For me, I don't think so. I have scoliosis, and although upon close inspection you can see that I am somewhat malformed, most of the issues right now are in the inside of my body. The author then asked the whole staff whether they would like to have tails. But it's not just not very funny attempts at humor. There's a column about how Mayim Bialik is destroying Jeopardy, which essentially boils down to her being a, quote, pro-Israel wet blanket. Or there's this, which I guess is what counts for investigative reporting at the news site. Quote, was Representative Steve Scalise shot in the dick? Asked the tarply hit headline. Somehow Gawker was able to find the most inconsequential element of the domestic terrorist attack on Scalise and other GOP congressmen. And even taking the absurd angle, the conclusion was, quote, the jury is out on the integrity of the congressman's dick and balls. So the reporter really just wrote the piece for the headline. Who is Gawker for? Is there any audience at all for this? Because there certainly used to be for the old Gawker, which pushed boundaries, was often funny, but did so with a sense of purpose, uniqueness, and essentiality. Now, it's irrelevant, at least so far. More with Dan Abrams coming up, but first, the Fourth Watch podcast is presented by The First TV. The First is a new network for free speech and big ideas featuring Bill O'Reilly, Dana Lash, Buck Sexton, and more. It's a forum for new thought, new approaches, and an enlightening voice for a new America that embraces the founding principles and ideals that form the greatest country on the planet. The First is free. No subscriptions, no credit cards, no trials, no censorship. You can watch The First TV on Pluto TV, Distro TV, Apple TV, The First TV app, and more. Go to thefirsttv.com to learn more. And now, back to Dan Abrams. What you're saying kind of leads to talking about Mediaite in general, because it feels like a lot of what you're bringing to the show now is what you talked to me about when I was coming over to Mediaite as that was launching in 2009, now 12 years ago, which is pretty incredible. Crazy. for digital Crazy. Media space, still going strong. And I'm curious, you think back to what the impetus was, what you thought was missing in the marketplace when you launched Mediaite, and how that translates to now, because I would say it's as relevant as ever right now.
Well, it's more relevant than ever. I mean, you know, the thinking behind Mediaite, which, you know, I don't like to engage in, you know, patting myself on the back,
but oh, come on.
I'm going to do it in this one particular instance. The idea behind Mediaite was that people are more interested in the media figures than they are the politicians, and that the proxies in the media for political positions are much more engaging than the Chuck Schumers and Mitch McConnells of the world. And that Rachel Maddow and Sean Hannity are much more engaging and interesting, and hearing what they have to say and covering them is more interesting than covering the politicians themselves. That was the thinking behind, and that was coming from having hosted cable news shows, right? I was saying, you know, people are always really interested in what the cable news hosts have to say. Yeah. And this was coming just as opinion was becoming sort of dominant in the cable news world. And that was the thinking behind the creation of Mediaite.
Yeah. And I think, you know, I have to say the Mediaite started, Twitter existed, but it was not nearly the force that it is now. And you sort of combine Mediaite with what Twitter has become, because I do, you know, one of the things that people maybe who are on the outside of the media world don't understand is just how much ego there is in the media, you know, space. Yeah. How much, I mean, I've talked to lots of people who want to read about themselves on Mediaite. I don't know if I've ever told you the story. I was at an MSNBC party in 2010, and Ed Schultz, RIP Ed Schultz, came up to me and said, you know, you always write about Keith Olbermann at Mediaite. I say crazy shit all the time. Why don't you write about me?
Right.
And I don't think that's really, I mean, it was, you know, maybe after a couple of drinks, Ed Schultz saying that. But I think a lot of people think about that as like, this is a place that's almost it's a little bit about ego, but it's also a validation that what I'm saying is having an impact.
I think that's true. But I will say that the story, and look, you know, I don't get into the day-to-day editing of the site. I, you know, they all do this autonomously. Aidan McLaughlin runs the site. Colby Hall, Joe DiPaolo, Josh Feldman, all of them. And so, you know, I don't get into any of the nitty gritty, but I do see stories that I'll pitch them. And then there are other stories I'll see on the site and I'll be like, why did you guys do this? And the stories that piss me off the most are the ones where it's like, Chris Hayes says something that Chris Hayes would of course say, right. You know? And I'm like, why is that news? Why do we have a headline that says Chris Hayes bashes Trump over blank?
Right.
I'm like, why is that interesting? I said, if Chris Hayes defends Trump, oh, now that's interesting. Now you've got a story. Or if Chris Hayes says something incredibly radical, right? Like, yeah. This is the end of society as we know. Okay, great. Now that's big enough. But the stories that make me nuts are the ones where it's just a headline of some cable news person saying something that you would expect that cable news person to say.
Right, right. Now you want to see, you know, you want to see something that is that's moving the needle, and those are obviously, I would imagine, the things that do the best are you know, being first, being early on the thing that everyone's going to talk about, right? And yep. And Twitter is the engine for that, and. Man, I can only imagine it's doing well. What's the end game for Mediaite now? You see a lot of stories now about places. I know The Hill just sold, and Politico, yeah. And others. What do you envision the end game for Mediaite?
Well, first of all, Mediaite is a tiny business compared to Law and Crime, the business that I have around. I mean, that's got a full network. It's available on basic cable. It's got the number one true crime website in America. It's got a huge production arm. So, I mean, you know, the vast majority of the employees who work for me work for Law and Crime. I say that just to say that when I'm thinking big picture of what's next, I'm typically thinking about Law and Crime. Mediaite's fun. I like Mediaite. I like having Mediaite. You know, I've had people approach me about Mediaite, but I recognize that the valuation on Mediaite, to me wouldn't be worth selling. So the only way that I could see, you know, do I blow it out at some point and really try and, you know, make it a 360 business? I might. I'm just doing too many other things right now to spend too much time envisioning it. I'm trying to actually consolidate a little bit more my businesses.
Right.
But you know, I like having Mediaite. And so I'm not really in the market to sell it. If someone said to me, well, you know, Law and Crime in order to move forward with some, you know, big picture issue on law, because we've had a lot of interest in Law and Crime lately. And I say this, you know, in the last 9 months, there's just been a lot of conversations with big media companies for exactly the reasons you're talking about. Just people are talking about acquiring content, et cetera. And the only way I'd consider Mediaite would be if someone said that they needed it as part of a deal.
The Fourth Watch Lightning Round is coming up, but first the Aussie media debacle and cancel culture coming for Live PD. What do you make of the Aussie story? Because, you know, Carlos Watson is now still, as of this moment, making the media rounds. It's been a fascinating insular media story.
It's nuts.
Someone who looks at, you know, you and I have been obsessed with analytics, I think. I certainly still am. I imagine you are as well, with traffic and with numbers and with, you know, chart beat back in the day. How can it be so far off from the reality and for so long?
Yep. I did this as a segment on my show the other day. And the angle that I took was that, you know, you heard someone like Brian Stelter say it was an open secret, right? That Ozzy was sort of a fraud. And my position is, if it was such an open secret, how did they allow it to continue? Now, I will say that I'm as guilty to some degree, in the sense that I remember, you know, a couple of years in thinking Ozzy's nothing. And then suddenly I'm seeing Carlos Watson at these major events, like hosting them, connection with Ozzy. And I'm like, wow, I was totally wrong about this business. But I think that part of it is that Ozzy was a liberal media darling.
Yeah.
I think that everyone, you know, oh, we got to partner with Ozzy because we've got to increase our diversity. And, you know, and it's like, no, you know, I mean, you know, and by the way, that was really bad for all these other diverse companies that didn't get those partnerships and instead went to Ozzy. But my point is, it was just a reflex reaction for many in the left-leaning, and I don't just mean news media, just in general, who needed to partner and wanted to be seen as making an effort to be diverse, and partnered with Aussie Media without really looking into what are they doing. And it's not just media companies, advertisers, it's everybody. And I think that was part of the problem. It's funny, you know, I when I talked about this, I had someone on who was talking about it from the perspective of other companies led by diverse CEOs that suffered as a result of Aussie kind of stealing the thunder. But there was no there because no one bothered to actually dig into the analytics on anything.
Right. Yeah. And probably will continue to suffer. I would imagine if there were investors who took a shot on Aussie and Carlos Watson and have been burned in this way, it's only going to have a worse reverberating effect, I feel like. It's an amazing story, but it's also, I think, really sad. And it's also reflective of just how much we're still in the Wild West of the digital media space. We don't really have the source. There's no Nielsen in any real way for,
yes, it's true. And look, ComScore is so notoriously inaccurate, but you know, if someone's going to put money into my company, they're going to demand to see my Google Analytics.
Right.
Right. At the least. The problem was that Aussie was positioning itself not as a digital media company, right? It was a brand. It was a lifestyle. It was about we're doing TV shows. We're doing this. We're doing that. And I can tell you that, you know, as someone who does that with Law and Crime, right, a lot of our business is the production arm. But, you know, when we're talking to prospective, you know, acquirers, investors, whatever the case may be, they're asking, you know, very specific questions about the contracts that we have for the next round of productions and, you know, what the margins are and this. So it has to be that people didn't ask those questions of Aussie.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing also. It's like, I do wonder like the private equity aspect of this, because if once you get to that level, you're not really looking at the numbers. That's almost secondary. It's the perception. It's the association. It's not so defined as the actual numbers. It's more of what's the story that you can weave and tell, and then how can you get your exit down the road?
Well, I'll tell you, every private equity, you know, look, I've chosen not to go with private equity, but anytime I've had those conversations, they've asked me a ton of questions about specifics.
Yeah.
And it hasn't just been like, oh, Dan Abrams is a, you know, blank guy. It's been a lot of details, a lot of due diligence questions, et cetera. So that's why I don't get it. I mean, you know, that's really where I would say, you know, when I mentioned that this effort to want to partner with Aussie, I don't just mean it from a media perspective. I mean it from a financial perspective. I mean it from an advertising perspective. I mean, you know, everyone. And it's like, it just seems like no one dug in at all in the way that I can assure you that every time I do a deal, they dig deep, or I even talk about a deal, they dig deep.
So funny. I mean, it's, I just can't believe Carlos is still going and it's not going away. So I'd imagine this will be.
It's going away. It's going to go away.
Eventually.
Carlos is going to. Yeah.
Yes.
I mean, because, you know, he won't identify who his investors are now. He's not going to identify who his advertisers are now. It's like, you know, it's going to go away. It's worked for so long, right? That I think he's still emboldened to think he's going to be able to get away with it again. He's going to have his Lazarus moment. and you know, so.
Amazing. All right. Let me ask you last thing before we get to the lightning round here. I want to talk about Live PD real quick, because you talk about having like 9,000 jobs. One of them up until last year was Live PD, which you hosted, and it was a huge hit. I mean, this was like the biggest show on cable, and it was canceled, you know, because of these, you know, this propaganda accusations that were going around there after the George Floyd. And it got me thinking about just like, it used to be, it felt like that the marketplace decided, right? It was like, okay, you know, this is the biggest show on cable, so it's above this sort of cancellation, you know, not in the literal cancellation, but in the sort of metaphorical one. But now it's like you get 100 loud people on Twitter and they can make a lot of noise and make some decisions. So what do you think this means for the future of media?
Look, I don't think it was Twitter. I think it was, you know, very active pressure that came from a lot of directions and a lot of interest groups force A&E to take live PD off the air. I wasn't involved in the discussions. I was just informed, and I was not happy about it. And I made that very clear. But I think that what you're seeing is that these things go through a cycle, right? Which is, you know, it was for a while, I was like, you know, a pariah because I was saying, I think this is an overreaction.
People need to go watch the amazing interview with Breonna Keeler on this, which was just fantastic.
That was a good example of it. You know, it was like this fury and anger about the shit. But what it really is a fury and anger at police. It's basically saying, you know, if you do anything that shines a light that is not negative on police, you're the enemy. I had a hit piece done on me recently about my new show in Salon that came out last week, where the writer was basically claiming that I was doing pro-cop propaganda on my show.
A former Mediaite writer, by the way.
Former Mediaite writer, who I'd never met before. Yeah. And by the way, I invited him to come on my show. And of course, he didn't want to do that. But the point is, it's not about him. It's that there is a broader sentiment, which is, well, Dan, and then the segments I'm doing on the show are body cam segments, right? Like cops surviving various difficult situations, et cetera, and taking people through what happened, either talking to the cops or talking to another cop about sort of how that situation got resolved. And, you know, that's viewed in this new world as controversial.
Yeah.
How could you be celebrating, you know, the police for the occasional thing that happens when they're out killing people all the time? And it's like, wow, that's where we are.
Yeah.
That, and by the way, these are some of the same people who will tell you, oh, well, the Capitol Police were good. I mean, right. it makes me crazy about the hypocrisy
on the
right is the Capitol Police are not heroes. It's like, wait, what? And then on the left, suddenly they love the Capitol Police, but they don't love the rest of them. So the insanity in this country around policing is reflected in the Capitol Police. You can just see, it all comes down to, which side you're on this. So,
yeah. And I have to say, I feel like there's a lot of fear also, there are some true believers on either side, and they're partisans and they're going to try to get their things. But I just think there's so much fear in the media of upsetting the wrong small group of people, that you get these overreactions.
Well, and look, and in particular, this is the challenge in being in the middle, right? Is you don't have that base of people who are going to have your back.
Right.
Is that you say something that offends a particular group or person or whatever it is. And unlike someone who shares your, view on everything and people will be rabid and say, we'll forgive, you're done. But look, that's the beauty of a place, where I'm at News Nation is, they're not in the media bubble. They're based out of Chicago. They're not in New York. They're not part of the media ecosystem.
Yeah.
And so, their position is say, call it like it is. And, we got your back. So I hope, I'm going to definitely be saying it like it is. So I'm hoping that's true.
That's a good place to be. I'm with you on that. All right. Last thing, six questions in 60 seconds. Where were you born?
Manhattan.
You are the founder of Mediaite, the host of Dan Abrams Live on News Nation. What's one benefit and one cost of those jobs?
Well, benefit of being the host of News Nation is that, I've been missing a little bit being part of the conversation on a lot of topics, even though I've got a radio show. The cost is on my personal life. I mean, I'm doing a lot of different things, and the amount of time it takes, I don't get home until after the show, which is live from 8 to 9, is rough.
Yeah. Who's someone who's been a mentor for you?
My dad, certainly. I think that that may be viewed as a cop out answer, but he's definitely been a great mentor.
Well, also as a media connection there as well. A mentor for anyone who cares about the First Amendment. Who is one person you really like professionally or personally that may surprise people?
Sean Hannity.
Who's one person?
I think he is, just a really, I really like him as a person, consider him a friend.
Nice. Who's one person in the media you think is really interesting or talented that isn't getting enough attention?
Interesting or talented, not getting enough attention. I'd have to think about that one. No one comes to mind immediately.
All right. 1 year from today, what's one prediction for the media?
I think we will be more divided than we are now. And that makes me incredibly sad.
On that happy note, Dan, thanks so much. That was great.
Steve, appreciate it. Always good to be with you.
Thanks to Dan Abrams. That was fun. Remember, Fourth Watch is not just a podcast, it's also a newsletter. Subscribe for free at fourthwatch.media. Join me. Let's build a better media together. If you like the music in the show as I do, check out the artist who created it, Super Duper. That's Super Duper Music on Instagram. The song is Far From Falling. Download it wherever you get your music. And download and follow and like, rate, review, all of that. This podcast on any of the podcast platforms, Spotify, Apple, wherever you are getting your podcasts. That does a lot to help the show. And we appreciate you listening, but even more downloading. Back soon. Stay safe. Talk to you then.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.